the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Friday, June 26, 2015. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled to preserve the Affordable Care Act, handing a stinging loss to Republicans. On today's show, we'll turn to Courage Campaign Executive Chairman Dr. Paul Song about what the ruling means. And in breaking news, the court also ruled on Friday to legalize gay marriage. We'll discuss the impact of the decision just as we approach the 46th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And 70 years after the signing of the United Nations Charter, we'll discuss how successful or not the UN has been. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Komanyika, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at Clemson University. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks for joining us. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, has reportedly carried out a horrific massacre in the Syrian border town of Kobani. The Kurdish town saw 145 of its residents killed in what is likely the second worst massacre ever carried out by ISIS. There were many children, women, and elderly among the killings, which were the result of three suicide bomb attacks. Meanwhile, three other incidents around the world are being attributed to ISIS. In Tunisia, an armed attack on a beach resulted in 27 deaths. In France, a U.S.-run chemical plant was attacked, with one person being beheaded and an unsuccessful attempt to blow up the entire plant. And in Kuwait, a mosque was attacked with eight people injured. ISIS had called for coordinated attacks during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Well, Chenjerai, don't these killings prove that the U.S.'s war on ISIS just hasn't worked and that it needs to find another approach?
I think it does. I think this is we're gonna see a continued, strain of analysis here that has to do with the fact that, this is kind of like, I think someone described it like a hit the mole approach, where we're trying to attack different leaders with drones. We should also relate this to comments yesterday and instances where we're bragging about a particular Al-Qaeda or ISIS leader being killed and things like this. And I think all of this detracts attention away from really trying to strengthen our civilian institutions and strategies that are beyond the military interventions that are needed here. Mm-hmm. So these attacks are tragic in Tunisia, Kuwait, and in France, and in Syria, as you mentioned. But we're going to have to think about an approach that can be much more structural and systemic.
And on Monday's program, we'll be speaking with Reese Ehrlich to discuss the massacre in Syria. Hours after the Supreme Court voted to preserve subsidies in the Affordable Care Act yesterday, it made another ruling on the Fair Housing Act. Having garnered very little coverage, the legal challenge to the Fair Housing Act was based on the premise that people of color no longer needed protection against housing discrimination. Given this court's propensity to gut civil rights era laws, the danger of reversing fair housing was high, but with a vote of 5-4, justices preserved it. The Washington Post explained, had a single justice, likely Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the opinion, felt differently, another key piece of civil rights law in the U.S. would have been substantially weakened, end of quote. Well, Chenjerai, how important was the preservation of this Fair Housing Act? Isn't the issue of housing discrimination on par with, say, police violence in its impact on communities of color?
Absolutely. I think it's an area where we see structural violence. And so in that way, it's also related to police brutality and killing, because we know that police act very differently in neighborhoods where there are homeowners with means. But I think housing discrimination is in some ways more straightforward. If you understand the history of it, and which you can find in books like Family Properties by Beryl Satter or Unfair Housing by Mara Sidney, what we see is the central role that those disparities, that those policies and practices play in producing and maintaining historic or racialized disparities. Now, we should also be concerned, though, when we look at this victory. It was, I think, a victory, but there are certain ways in which the Fair Housing Act was limited by this ruling as well. And, I think that was mainly in areas where the way that you have to make the case for housing discrimination, making it more comprehensive, which makes it harder to make the case because these things are not always explicitly intentional.
And finally, thousands of people are attending funeral services for the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, one of the nine people massacred at last week's terror attack at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Reverend Pinckney, a state senator, was beloved in his community. President Obama will be delivering his eulogy, and a number of high-level federal and state officials are expected. Meanwhile, police have found that the suspected terrorist, Dylan Roof, who has confessed to his killing spree, was actually hoping to get his hands on a much more dangerous weapon, an AR-15 assault rifle. Had he obtained a rifle, the scope of his actions would likely have been far greater. And as if to prove how irrelevant Fox News is, on this day of Reverend Pinckney's funeral, the right-wing news outlet ran a story headlined, "Why Didn't Anyone Help Dylan Roof. The piece, authored by Dr. Keith Albo, used tortured logic to ask why no one intervened since Roof was obviously mentally ill. Well, Chandra, you were in Charleston last week when we spoke to you there. How do you view the situation a week later?
Well, things have moved forward. We're actually now having the funerals of the people who were martyred there. But, you know, this framing that Fox News did, this was also something taken up by Glenn Beck. And I was actually there in front of Emmanuel at Emmy Church when Glenn Beck brought his followers to the church, and they began to chant All Lives Matter and to kind of roll out his framing of depraved indifference or whatever it was. And I think this is really just a way, I mean, of course, the issue of mental illness is important, but this is an issue way of avoiding the deep systemic and cultural issues that people are recognizing around the country and the issue of gun control. I mean, when you have, you know, in the state like I live in, South Carolina, and people in Mississippi talking about the Confederate flag, what they're talking about is recognizing the deep cultural issues, the way that those things are related to this. And this is something that Fox News and some on the conservative right are still trying to deny. So they're kind of really behind the curve, even within the conservative thinking.
Chandra, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Chandra Kumanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The United States Supreme Court yesterday ruled 6-3 in favor of preserving subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, handing President Obama a definitive win on his signature law. For the Republicans, this was a stinging loss, the final nail in the coffin on their attempts to undo what they've called Obamacare. The case at the heart of the ruling was King versus Burwell, a legal challenge that was based on a technicality. The Los Angeles Times explained that legal experts saw it, quote, as a fatuous misreading of the law and a tortured effort to bend the process of statutory interpretation for ideological ends, end of quote. But privately, some Republicans expressed relief, knowing that if 6.2 million Americans relying on subsidies had suddenly lost them, the GOP would have paid a stiff political price. Joining me in studio today is Paul Song, executive chairman of the Courage Campaign, a board-certified radiation oncologist, longtime activist in the fight for universal health care, and he was also named the very first visiting fellow in the California Department of Insurance. He's an executive board member of Physicians for National Health Program and co-chair of Californians of a Campaign for Healthy California. Welcome to Uprising, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to the show, I should say, since we've had you on before to talk about these challenges to the Affordable Care Act. Can you first explain the technicality on which the case was brought? There have been many legal challenges to the ACA. Was this a sort of last-ditch, desperate attempt to gut it?
Yes, it was. And really, it was based on some sloppy lack of transparency and reading of the bill that was written. So there was a clause in that said that all of the subsidies would be set for people to buy health care under state-run exchanges. But as you know, a lot of the states balked at setting up their own exchanges, and the federal government was forced to step in and set up the exchanges. And what this basically was saying is that they were really breaking the law because it was only meant to buy a subsidy that was set up by the state but not by the federal government. Mm-hmm. So it was based on those few words. Now, yesterday everybody was, you had a lot of different opinions, but what we know about Justice Roberts is he's always about protecting corporations. And this was really less about protecting patients as more as it was protecting the health insurance industry, hospitals, and all of the medical corporations that would have really suffered a lot of harm, not to mention the 6.2 million people.
Right, because the subsidies that those millions of Americans are receiving receiving are going to health insurance companies to provide these millions of people with health care. It's essentially the federal government giving tax dollars to help poor people get insurance from insurance companies that are private companies.
Correct. So I always say that this is less of a government-run program, but it's a corporate bailout. It really is giving people money to buy a product from a for-profit industry that only makes money by denying care. So, of course, Justice Roberts was going to protect the corporations.
Right. So it's interesting because the Affordable Care Act makes health insurance companies stronger, and this is something the right has always wanted, and they helped to write the law in the first place. So the challenges, the legal challenges, one after the other to the ACA, were ultimately always about delegitimizing or trying to delegitimize President Obama, since mm-hmm. this was a signature law, right?
Correct.
It was always a political move.
So it was originally touted by Richard Nixon as a foil to Senator Kennedy's more comprehensive health care plan. And then since then, the Heritage Foundation had always thought about this individual mandate, personal responsibility, and the idea of using tax credits to allow people to buy health insurance rather than setting up a more comprehensive single-payer healthcare system. So when Governor Romney did this in Massachusetts, you didn't have Republicans come out and really blast this. If anything, a lot of people thought that was a good idea. A lot of this, again, has to go to the fact that we have a president that is highly unpopular among the Republicans. And had anyone else proposed this, I think they would have thought, wow, this is a great Republican idea.
Exactly. Had it been proposed under a Republican presidency, we would have seen a very different approach. And so what it has ended up doing, looking at this entire fight now, is that it has left progressives with the awkward task of having to defend the Affordable Care Act, right?
Correct. So I, as somebody who wanted us to do much more, I have to say that it's very hard for me to defend certain aspects of the ACA. But there are people that are greatly benefiting. Those who prior to the law were facing lifetime caps where they would lose coverage entirely. Others, because of pre-existing conditions, couldn't get health care. So there are some really great things in there. The only problem that we see, certainly, is that there are still 35 million people that are going to be uninsured as a result of the ACA. The one thing that Democrats and Republicans could agree on when it came to health care was to exclude our undocumented brothers and sisters. The next thing was that the amount of lifetime or the yearly deductibles for a family of four was now $13,200, and for an individual is $6,600. So that's a lot of money for most people. They don't have that kind of money sitting around. So the number of people that are delaying getting health care, even though having insurance because they can't afford copays and deductibles, is still too high. Just this past year, we had 1.7 medical-related bankruptcies in the United States, of which 75% of those people had insurance.
So 1.7
million people in the United States. Now, and then this year, it's anticipated up to 10 million people in the United States who have insurance will get health care costs that they can't afford. So the idea that having insurance necessarily protects you from medical bankruptcies is a complete fallacy. We believe that it's, again, the insurance companies are really gaming the system. Just last week, just yesterday, once the news hit, their stocks climbed.
Right.
They're at all-time highs. They're making record profits. You're seeing more and more consolidation. And those are the issues that are not being addressed by the ACA. Mm.
Let's, just for a minute, talk about the fact that if the court had ruled against the subsidies in the Affordable Care Act based on this technicality, what would have been the result? Either millions of people would have lost their subsidies, or would Congress have gone back to correct the technical problem? Probably not, right? I can't see Congress going back with the GOP in charge of both the House and the Senate going back and rewriting it.
Yeah, so it was anticipated that of the states, the states that set up exchanges, or the people that were getting coverage in states that didn't set up their own exchanges and relied on the federal government, there were 6.2 million people, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And the problem would have been they would have immediately been scrambling, and there was no alternative plan in place, either by the Republicans or by the White House. The White House had no contingency plan in place, so it would have been a huge disaster. Mm. I think in the end, they really were confident that this would pass.
And of course, the GOP itself would have paid a political price, because very likely those people who are voters who lost their health insurance as a result of this might have punished the GOP from the long view, again, for those who want to see a single-payer healthcare system. And I want to get to the efforts on that in a minute. You know, we often sort of fantasize theoretically about what it would take to get single payer, and a lot of people hurting very badly would have given more impetus. But of course, it's a lot of people hurting very badly, and nobody ever wants that.
Exactly. And I think what happens is when you call it Obamacare, a lot of people don't find it appealing, particularly those that live in these red states. But then if you look at states like Kentucky, where a lot of people...
Are you suggesting the people who live in red states might be racist?
Well, I don't know if they're racist or ideologically been brainwashed to believe that this is against their best interest. But if you look at states like Kentucky, which is traditionally a red state, they've set up one of the more successful exchanges called Connect, and you see the satisfaction increasing for people that have not had coverage before. With regard to how we get to the next step, I think it's going to be inevitable. Certainly, if you look at California, we have over $150 billion of unfunded health care liabilities for our state employees, many of them who are retired, and it's a ticking time bomb. One of the things we know about the ACA, while it's reducing costs, that still is a percentage of GDP. We're spending way too much as a nation. It's unsustainable, the waste that's there. And at some point, people are going to realize we're going to have to look at our most successful healthcare system, which is Medicare. Medicare is run much more efficiently. It keeps costs down. Patients are great and more satisfaction. There's less government interference between a doctor and a patient, unlike the private insurance industry. And it's just a matter of time where that's going to happen. Now, in 2017, as part of the ACA, there is a provision for federal waivers for states to opt out and adopt their own healthcare system as long as it meets the base requirements. And this is where I think you're going to see more and more states adopt that. New York, their legislature had passed, the state assembly had passed a single payer provision. It still has to go through the Senate and probably will not make it out this session. But the idea is that there's more and more people learning about what single payer is, and it's going to happen.
I'm glad to hear you're so optimistic about single payer because having been in the position of having to defend the Affordable Care Act, it seemed as though progressives had sort of given up on single-payer health care. Single-payer health care, for those who might not be familiar with the term, is essentially Medicare for all, cutting out insurance companies altogether, where people simply pay their tax dollars to the government. That money, in turn, provides everybody with health care. Everybody's included, nobody's excluded. Now, in California, prior to the ACA, there was an effort when we didn't have a Democratic governor in office. What has happened to that effort, and has it essentially been trumped by the ACA? Does California have to wait till 2017?
So, yes, all states have to wait till 2017. Vermont had initially planned to start, but then they found it was just too expensive for them to adopt. And the way they approached it, I think a lot of people realized, was not the correct way. In California, in the past, we've passed single-payer bills, most recently SB 810, only to have it vetoed by our governor. When Governor Brown became governor, Governor Schwarzenegger. When Governor Brown became governor, there was actually another opportunity to pass the bill, and that time, true Democrats who were beholden to the private insurance industry came out and voted against it or abstained. What we need to do, just like anything else, is to educate our electorate, educate the citizens about why single-payer Medicare for all is truly the best way. And then we need to start removing the corporate influence from our legislature, particularly the private insurance industry. The private insurance industry is doing just fine. Their CEOs, some of the CEOs, are making over $100 million a year in terms of compensation in stocks. And we need to show that that's money that should be better spent to actually take care of patients. You know, just this past year, Kaiser spent millions of dollars to defeat an initiative here in the state that would have regulated insurance rates. Because in California, the rates have gone up 153% in the last 9 years, whereas inflation has only gone up 29% and wages have remained stagnant. I don't know of any other industry that has had that successive rise, even in a recession. And instead of using that money to spread negative lies that protect the status quo, we should be giving that money back to the people of California. And the ultimate way to do that is to remove the private insurance industry entirely from the equation and let a true Medicare for all system work.
I mean, essentially, insurance companies are a middleman between patients and doctors. That's all they are, sucking up profits.
Absolutely. And the other thing I will say is...
I mean, they're managed care. They provide managed care. This is this term that they use.
Exactly. And unlike Medicare, which is completely undermined all the time by congressional bills that really favor the insurance industry or the pharmaceutical industry through Medicare Advantage or Medicare Part D. Just an example, despite the fact that Congress makes it impossible for Medicare to use its power to negotiate drug prices, it still has lower administrative costs than the private insurance industry. But when you see United Healthcare use its market share to negotiate drug price discounts, it's considered savvy business or the free market.
Right.
But when Medicare tries to do it, it's considered government interference.
Wow. So very briefly, in this past week, despite the fact that the Supreme Court decision is a win, at least for people who are struggling and who have managed to get subsidies for their health insurance, another thing that happened was Trade Promotion Authority passed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the way in which this is related to our access to healthcare is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, if it passes, well, if Obama brings it to Congress for an up or down vote, which is what he now has the power to do, and if Congress gives it an up vote in the majority, TPP will be the law of the land. How will that impact healthcare in the U.S.?
It'll be a disaster for healthcare. Many organizations who have been traditionally non-political, like Medicine Without Frontiers, Doctors Without mm-hmm. Borders, have basically said that one of the provisions in this will protect the pharmaceutical industry. It will prolong the length of patents. It will reduce the ability to find generic drugs, which are so crucial to keeping healthcare costs down in the rest of the world. There's a lot of other secret things in there that we don't know, but from what we can tell, it will have a disastrous impact and further elevate sort of the for-profit nature of our healthcare system.
Wow. So finally, going back to the issue of the fight for single-payer healthcare, is now the time for states, because our program is aired nationally, is now the time for people in states around the country to start building momentum for 2017 to get their state lawmakers readying a bill to transform their systems?
Absolutely. And one of the ways to start is this July 30th is the 50th anniversary of Medicare. So in spite of all of the lies and interference by the government, Medicare still remains our most successful program. And what we want to do is really build on that. And there will be rallies up and down the state, one in Los Angeles, one in Oakland, where we're going to be able to really tout what Medicare is about and why Medicare for All is the next step. So I would encourage all your listeners to really go to either the Campaign for Healthy California website or Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP's website, to learn more about what a Medicare for All system is about, to get involved, to really start to educate their family members, because whether or not we take the initiative route here in California or do legislatively, we need more of our electorate to be informed and engaged.
And that's Campaign for a Healthy California or Physicians for National Health Program. Paul, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. I hope the next time we have you on, it'll be to talk about specifically how California is getting ready to adopt this bill for single payer.
I hope so too. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. My guest, Paul Song, is executive chairman of the Courage Campaign. He's a board certified radiation oncologist, longtime activist in the fight for universal health care. He's also an executive board member of Physicians for a National Health Program and co-chair of the Campaign for a Healthy California. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll take a look at another Supreme Court ruling that just happened this morning. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to legalize marriage. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's official. Marriage is legal. The United States Supreme Court this morning ruled 5-4 that under the United States Constitution, same-sex marriage is a national legal right. Justice Anthony Kennedy, breaking the deadlock, sided with his liberal colleagues and wrote the majority opinion. Last year, the court had issued a mixed ruling on several cases and essentially avoided making a definitive decision. It is fitting that the court's decision comes just before the 46th anniversary of the Stonewall riots on June 28, 1969. New York police raided a popular gay bar in Greenwich Village called the Stonewall Inn. That raid and the resistance to it sparked a major movement that is considered the birthplace of the modern American gay rights movement. On Tuesday of this week, just days ahead of the 46th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, the city of New York declared Stonewall an official landmark. It's the first time that the city has dedicated a monument to LGBT rights. Letitia James, a public advocate with the city, said the Stonewall Inn, quote, must be protected against rapacious developers who would destroy the history of the sacred place and all it represents. My guest is Dorothy Benz. She is the communications director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Uprising, Dorothy.
Hi, it's great to be here on such a great day.
Such a historic and momentous day. We didn't expect the ruling to come down just ahead of our conversation. First, I just want to ask you to express your thoughts. I was sort of tongue-tied this morning, tears of joy. How did you feel?
It was not unexpected. You know, the legal winds have been going in this direction for a while, and yet, I was completely overwhelmed for a couple of minutes, even though it was expected at this point. I'm very happy. I'm very glad that this piece of the journey for gay rights is over. And when I read Kennedy's closing line, you know, they ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. It's hard not to get choked up when you read that. And at the same time, it's such a moment in history, and as you say, so fitting in the coming right before the Stonewall anniversary. And yet, I can't help thinking about Reverend Pinckney right now and his funeral today, and the distance between that atrocity and that hate and this moment of love. It's just overwhelming.
I'm so glad that you brought up Reverend Pinckney. You know, this has been an issue that has often been put on the shoulders of religious leaders, that people have used religion to justify the denial of marriage. Near the end, it became about children and children's right, and how somehow the raising of children was the prime reason why marriage existed. Do you think that in the end, the Supreme Court simply saw through all of that and realized that the moment that we're in today, with the public opinion on marriage changing so dramatically, that they just would not have been able to get away with, I guess it would have been Anthony Kennedy, wouldn't have been able to get away with a no vote?
I think in the end, I'd like to say it's a secular society and we are a nation of laws and not a theocracy, although sometimes I wonder about that. But I think in the end, the strength of the legal argument that we are protected under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was just unavoidable. And it is true that religious bigotry in this country is significant and is the significant force that's holding back rights for LGBTQ people. And yet the Constitution exists and legal scholarship exists, and you know, and I think it was unavoidable for them. I don't think they would have taken the case if they didn't know that they had to finally walk this road.
So this issue now, I mean, I don't, you know, it's so new, so the legal ramifications are far and wide, but 36 states, in the absence of a federal Supreme Court ruling, 36 states already legalized marriage. Does this ruling now mean that it doesn't matter whether a state or not has legalized marriage in the eyes of the federal government, it is legal? Or is it the case that those people living in states where marriage is still not legal can simply file federal taxes as a married couple, but not state taxes? Do you know what the ramifications are?
I don't actually know. I haven't read the ruling itself, and I'm not actually a lawyer or a legal scholar, so I don't want to overstretch what the actual specific immediate logistical implications are. But it is clear that the highest court of our nation has ruled that we have an equal right to marriage to all couples. So whatever the implementation is, we will be able to get married everywhere. And I've seen accounts of people having long lines at city clerk's offices looking for marriage licenses. So I think we're off to the races already, but I don't want to overstep my knowledge.
Sure, and we will certainly try to bring more details of that on this program as the details of the ruling and the decision that was written. We have more time to look through that. And also briefly, how does the U.S. now compare to the rest of the world? I mentioned 36 states in the U.S., but there are many countries around the world that are turning in this direction as well in terms of making marriage legal, right?
Yes, I don't know how many, but it's a growing number. We're certainly not first in the pack. That's no longer surprising, but there are a growing number of nations. And I believe that earlier this month, the United Nations also called for the decriminalization of homosexuality worldwide, which, you know, apart from marriage as a right, there are so many other legal rights and social rights and economic rights that LGBTQ people need to have and in most places don't have. For instance, it's an irony, but true, that right now, I may be able to get married. Actually, I am married, but I may be able to get married in 50 states in this country. But in 31 of them, I believe it's 31, I could still be discriminated against in employment and housing.
Well, how important is the symbolism of this decision? Because you're right, beyond the issue of marriage, there are many other issues and avenues of discrimination. Isn't the legalization of gay marriage nationwide also a symbolic issue that now you have a right that straight folks take for granted? And this is a symbolic step in simply the fact that we're all human. You're right. I mean, that this is, you know, it can be ticked off the list, but also hopefully have ramifications in people being able to be seen as equal in everyone's eyes.
I think that that's true. I mean, it's true in a number of ways, and it is more than symbolic. There are a lot of legal rights
Right. Caught
up with being able to be married, you know, whether that's visitation rights in a hospital or inheritance rights or, you know, any number of things that straight folks do take for granted. But the equal protection argument, I mean, again, I'm not a legal scholar, but I don't understand why it's not a very short jump from saying that we're protected for the purpose of marriage to saying we're protected for the purposes of everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we have rights under the law that say you can't discriminate against us because we're gay, then those should extend everywhere. And I think I hope that we'll see a renewed effort to finalize and pull through other civil rights for LGBTQ people. And I also hope that we will focus more intently on the crises that are so far removed from marriage that the more marginalized and younger and more vulnerable members of our community face day in and day out. I'm thinking about bullying in schools. I'm thinking about homelessness for queer youth. I'm thinking about the epidemic of hate violence that affects mostly queer people of color, and particularly trans women of color. Those are huge pressing issues for our communities. And I hope that this moment of love wins will help extend the fight in those directions.
And speaking of trans women of color, a very important event took place this week when an undocumented trans woman named Genesette Gutierrez heckled President Obama during a White House event on LGBT issues. And he cut her down snarkily, saying it was his house and the drinks and the food that she was consuming, and she was escorted out. But she was demanding that the president and the government stop detaining and deporting LGBT undocumented immigrants. And I'm wondering what you make of that encounter and how immigrant rights intersect with LGBT rights. If marriage is now legal, then the same-sex marriages that people have between U.S. citizens and, say, undocumented immigrants might give those immigrants a right to apply for green card, as straight couples have been able to do.
They should. It should enable that to happen, for sure. And, you know, I feel... I feel bad for the president when he gets heckled, especially since he gets heckled so much in a racist way. Mm. But I have to say, in this case, he deserved it. It's not the most pleasant of interactions, but making your voice heard is a time-honored tradition in our country, and it needed to be said, because there are issues that LGBT immigrants face that are not being addressed in immigration reform and in the discussions around immigration around our country. Trans women are usually detained along with males. LGBTQ people are often put in solitary confinement in immigration detention, allegedly for their own benefit. Asylum laws need to be updated and, you know, to protect the very real threat that people face. There are tons of issues that affect our community, and immigration is absolutely a queer issue. Just like racism is a queer issue, and classism is a queer issue, and ableism is a queer issue. We queer people, we come in all stripes and colors, from all backgrounds and all colors, and all those issues of justice are our issues.
Now, let's talk about the fact that it is the 46th anniversary of the Stonewall riots this week. And this has been the Stonewall riots 46 years ago. And the organizing that came out of that was seen as such a crucial chapter in the fight for gay rights. Can you tell us, can you put it into context, the historical context of why Stonewall became so important, why it's called the birthplace for gay rights?
It definitely deserves that title. It's a little hard to know why that day was different. I mean, in some ways there are explanations for it, and in some ways there are not. But Stonewall started, what we call the Stonewall riots or the Stonewall Rebellion, started as just another bar raid. Bar raids were common in that time. The Stonewall itself was raided approximately every 2 weeks. And throughout the country, people, you know, faced bar raids all the time in towns and cities. And there were some places where, you know, the town newspaper would publish the names of the people arrested. And in those days, that meant an end to your life, almost, you know, because it went a certain loss of job, it meant an almost certain loss of family. It was the sort of airtight stigmatism and complete ostracization that known homosexuals faced is almost unimaginable to us today. And that's the era in which Stonewall happened. But what happened on that night was somehow different, because when the cops pulled up and they pulled up their paddy wagon and they started clearing out the bar, instead of scattering, everybody in the street kind of gathered in a crowd. And then, you know, who knows what the final spark was, but some cop pushed a drag queen a little bit too hard and she swung back, and boom, you know, the match that lit the fire was somehow ignited, and it turned into 2 nights of solid rioting and another 3 nights of an uneasy semi-rioting and then a sixth night of rioting again, and, you know, newspaper coverage, and all of a sudden people were shouting gay pride, gay power, in, you know, something they'd never done. No one had ever fought back.
And how did the sort of violence of the raid and people's resistance to it then spread far and wide beyond New York? How was this such a seminal event? Was it that people hadn't really, you know, fought back physically, particularly against the police, which, as we know, even till today, is a very dangerous thing to do. When a cop hits you, to hit a cop back is pretty much, you're guaranteed spending the night in jail and then probably being charged with assault. A police officer. Was it the courage of that lashing back and standing up for oneself, something that rippled far beyond New York?
It's, I think it was partially the historical moment. And I want to take a moment to also acknowledge that there was tremendous courageous efforts that happened before Stonewall. Mm. You know, it's not like the first activities and the first actions and the first fight back ever occurred there. But what came before had been an effort to fit in and to assimilate and to appeal to our common humanity and all those things. And suddenly in that night, it changed. And part of what made it happen was that it came in the context. It was 1969. You had the civil rights movement, you had the black power movement, you had the anti-war movement, you had the women's movement, you had the new left, the counterculture, the hippies, and all those things provided inspiration. They provided models, and they provided some infrastructure too. And they provided, you know, it was an age of rebellion in some ways. And so when that spark finally happened, it fired the imagination, and people, you know, people who had heard black is beautiful were capable of saying gay pride, you know, in a way that wouldn't have been possible without that. So the movement that came out of Stonewall absolutely stands on the shoulders of all of those movements that came before and that so inspired us in the 1960s. And then after it happened, those same movements also provided essentially a substitute infrastructure for people, because some of the leaders that came out of Stonewall were people that were already active in New Left organizations, and they had networks and they had skills. And, you know, and within a few weeks you had the Gay Liberation Front, and then a few weeks hence from there you had the Gay Activist Alliance. And those things were possible in part because so many queer people were already mobilized and politically active in those other movements.
And how important is it for the Stonewall Inn to be recognized as a landmark this week?
It's entirely appropriate, and it's a wonderful move. And coming together with the other great news from this week, it just fits. I mean, it's important, first of all, because we have to remember our history, and that's where it happened. That's where this all went down, and it is probably the single most transformative event in LGBTQ history. And the Stonewall has also been, since that time, the place that people gather spontaneously when something happens. I would be very surprised if it were Sheridan Square in front of the Stonewall right this minute as you and I are speaking, were not full of queer people, you know, hooting and hollering and shouting and drinking and crying and celebrating this moment. I know that I was there the day that Lawrence v. Texas was decided, the case that overturned the sodomy laws. And I know I was there on June 24th, 2011, the day that New York State legalized marriage. You know, and I was one of thousands, and nobody sent out a notice that said, let's all gather at the Stonewall. People just showed up there. So it has resonance. It has resonance. And it is the first landmark to be designated primarily because of its interest and significance to LGBT history, which is also important. But it's absolutely the right mark.
Dorothy, finally and very briefly, as we look ahead to other issues, I know that aside from the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage this morning, there are other cases pending as well, both on the international stage and at the domestic level. Internationally, there is a law that there is a challenge to the perpetrator of Uganda's extremely harsh homophobic law that essentially sentences or can sentence members of the LGBT community to death. And there's also a New York challenge to the impact of stop and frisk by the NYPD on LGBT folks. Can you just give us a very brief update on what these cases are about and why they're important?
Absolutely. Internationally, what has happened is that as rights have been growing in this country, the extremists here have taken their hate show on the road. They have exported their homophobic agendas elsewhere, to Africa and Eastern Europe and places like that. And Scott Lively is one of the worst of the bunch. He's basically a one-man persecution consulting operation. And in Uganda, he did help pass that law. He did advocate for that law, and he has worked together with people there to clamp down on gay rights and gay expression in our very existence. The law, just incidentally, the final law that passed did not include the death penalty. It was still extremely draconian, and it was invalidated on a technicality. But the damage is done, and his role in, you know, basically fomenting hate, which is under international law persecution and has been recognized as persecution by a court. That case is proceeding. It is far from done, but it is proceeding. And meanwhile, in New York, stop and frisk policies, which most people know, target black and brown New Yorkers. They also target trans New Yorkers and gender nonconforming people, and CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, won a landmark case against the NYPD in 2013 about stop and frisk. And we are now in the process of ramping up a reform process that the judge ordered that requires affected communities to be involved. And so those do include LGBTQ communities as well as people of color in New York. And that process is really just getting underway. We'll be telling people about both on Sunday at the Pride March, where CCR will be proudly marching along with thousands and thousands of other jubilant New Yorkers.
I can only imagine what that day is going to look like. Dorothy, thank you so much for sharing these thoughts with us. And I'm sure you're going to be celebrating tonight, maybe all weekend, as will I.
I certainly will. Thank you so much.
Dorothy Benz is the communications director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. If you haven't heard, marriage is now legal. We can stop calling it gay marriage and simply call it marriage. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll take a look at another anniversary, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. 70 years ago today, the United Nations Charter was signed at the San Francisco War Memorial and Performing Arts Center in California. The Charter is the foundational treaty of the United Nations and was signed by 50 out of 51 signatories. And the goal of the organization, as per that charter, was, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. The very first principle in the UN Charter is to maintain international peace and security, and to that end, to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of threats to the peace and for the suppression of acts of aggression or other breaches of the peace, and to bring about by peaceful means and in conformity with the principles of justice and international law, adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations which might lead to a breach of the peace. By most measures, the United Nations, although noble in its aspirations, has failed to live up to its stated principles. And joining me now to explain how is James Paul. He's a former executive director of Global Policy Forum, and he recently wrote an article for the Interpress Service entitled simply, "The United Nations Disappoints on its 70th Anniversary." Welcome to Uprising, Jim.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Sonali.
Well, the title of your article makes it as clear as possible. Let's first start with history. What were the political issues of the day that led to the formation of the United Nations? And before the UN, we had the League of Nations, right?
Well, the League of Nations, of course, had failed to prevent World War II, but the immediate surrounding situation in the formation of the UN was, of course, the war itself, this tremendous war lasting about 6 years, with so many millions killed, so many millions displaced, and the Holocaust and all the rest. And so the United Nations had been proposed at different times, particularly by Roosevelt and Churchill, in their meetings during the course of the war. It was their way of saying the world after this war is going to be different, going to be more peaceful, it's going to be more just. And so that is why there was a tremendous amount of public enthusiasm for this, and in a sense that this was the right time and the right thing to do.
So how enthusiastically was the UN's formation met? Were people really idealistic when it was formed? Did they really expect the UN to be able to end war, or at least resolve wars as they break out, in a peaceful manner?
Well, of course, the term United Nations had been originally applied to the Allies in the war. And the sense was that when many of the world's most important nations get together and seek, you know, an end to conflict, that could be possible. And the sense of the United Nations Charter was that that same alliance would stay together and would more or less make sure that there wasn't any future wars of the same kind that had been in World War II. So I think there was a certain enthusiasm at the policy level in Washington, but of course, in Washington in particular, there was also a sense that this was an institution that was going to manage the world in Washington's favor in the post-war period. Naturally, the enthusiasm of the public, and that is sort of somewhat represented by Eleanor Roosevelt and her initiatives around this, the public enthusiasm didn't take into account the fact that there were tremendous interests at stake that were going to be pursuing, let's say, goals that were not going to necessarily lead to peace in the post-war period. And, of course, we had the Cold War very soon afterwards.
Now, isn't the United Nations, by its very structure, set up to have the interests of superpowers trump that of smaller nations? We have the General Assembly, which is a very sort of democratic, at least, you know, theoretically democratic institution or body, I should say. But then there's a Security Council that the privileged few powerful countries and then a rotating set of countries have access to trump things that the General Assembly might vote on. Didn't that by itself ensure that the supremacy of superpowers would continue?
Yes, it certainly did. In fact, in the discussions at Dumbarton Oaks, for example, in 1944, when the Soviet Union, the UK, and the US, with also some Chinese participation, started talking about what the UN was really going to look like, the conclusion of those powerful nations was that they would have to have some kind of veto power in the new Security Council. And the others, the smaller countries, and there was 50 altogether, and minus the big five was 45, and most of those 45 were opposed to a veto power, but the veto power was more or less forced down their throat, and this has been the most serious problem in the UN Security Council, and leading to a kind of very despotic way in which policy is conducted in the Council. But we should remember that actually of the five permanent members with veto, it's really two that run the Council, the United States in particular, but also the UK.
Right,
the
of course.
The other three are along for the ride mostly.
And also we've had, I mean, let's briefly talk about the other ways in which the UN has been undermined. For example, the formation and the kind of the turning to of other alternative bodies, NATO, for example, which took over peacekeeping operations in Afghanistan as one example. And then we have the G8 as well. These institutions that are being formed outside and are being used outside the United Nations end up undermining the United Nations. And there's also the issue of a huge lack of funds that the United Nations suffers from. Do those two also contribute to the UN not being able to live up to its charter?
Absolutely. In fact, the business of shifting decision-making outside the UN, the case of the G20 is very interesting because I've always thought that the possibility for clipping the wings, reducing the power of the United States in particular and the P5 in more broadly, could be accomplished with the participation of the second-tier countries. And I'm thinking of Brazil, South Africa, India, Germany, Japan, in particular, and they could have done this, and they still could do it within the UN, But instead, they wanted to join the club, and they insisted on having permanent membership in the Security Council for themselves, for example. And they wanted to set up the G20 in order to have to be part of this club, like the G7, but somewhat enlarged. So unfortunately, the problem isn't limited to the United States, but the problem goes wider, and it has a certain, there's a certain geostrategic interest that that's how states define their role in international politics. And if they were to act somewhat differently, the whole international structure could come up differently. As far as the business of funding is concerned, the UN's budget this year is $2.7 billion. For the regular budget, and by comparison, the city of New York's budget is $75
billion. Wow.
The state of New York has more. Of course, the federal budget is gigantic.
So it's crippled by that. We just have about a minute left, Jim, and I just want to briefly ask you as well how the fact that the UN's war prevention efforts, or what it was supposed to be war prevention, has now slowly morphed into war fighting efforts under the auspices of so-called peacekeeping. We hear of peacekeeping missions of the UN in various countries around the world, but in effect, many of them end up doing some sort of war fighting, right?
Absolutely. The UN has more than 100,000 troops in the field. It uses now what are called robust peacekeeping methods. The peacekeeping used to be just, very lightly armed peacekeepers that were interposed between fighting forces. And now UN peacekeeping goes out and tries to win wars in different circumstances. Very often, these peacekeeping missions create more conflict than they solve. And so it's changed the perceptions within the UN Security Council and towards solutions to problems based on the use of force. And it's a terrible irony that the UN would have been transformed in this particular way.
And we will post a link to your lengthy article in Interpress Service on our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today, so our audience can get the fullness of your arguments on this day, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. Jim Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
James Paul is a former executive director of Global Policy Forum, and his article in Interpress Service was entitled "The United Nations Disappoints on its 70th Anniversary." This is Uprising. Anna Bus is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor and audio engineer with help from Federico Garcia. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for technical assistance. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com, and our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday.